The headlines this hour. Iran's president repeats calls for guarantees from the U.S. to revive the JCPOA as he leaves Tehran for New York to take part in the U.N. General Assembly meeting. Moscow dismisses Kiev's claims of extrajudicial killings after mass graves were discovered in a city once controlled by Russian forces in eastern Ukraine. And Palestinian students march across the occupied West Bank to voice support for their colleagues in East Al-Quds, who are protesting Israel's attempts to distort school textbooks. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president says that he will use his visit to the U.S. for the U.N. General Assembly to openly defend the rights of the nation and to highlight acts of oppression against it. Ebrahim Raisi further stressed that no meetings with U.S. officials will take place during the visit. Earlier this week, he told CBS News Network that Iran cannot trust the U.S. with what he called meaningless promises on the nuclear deal. Raisi said that Iran is serious about reviving the 2015 agreement. He noted, however, that this will hinge on Washington offering relevant guarantees not to follow suit on former U.S. President Donald Trump to withdraw from the accord. We earlier asked journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier about the importance of Raisi's visit to New York for the U.N. General Assembly meeting. Here's what he had to tell us.
Importance of this visit, it comes just a few days after the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting where the representative of half of the world were in one room and Iran had become an official part of the organization that calls also to end the U.S. unilateralism over the world. And President Raisi is in a position today to criticize again the U.S. unilateral and illegal sanctions on the Iranian population, which is the right of Iran to live in dignity without being under the harsh sanctions imposed by the U.S. So it is an opportunity for Iran to slam the U.S. sanctions again and also to show to the world that it's possible to survive without the U.S. hegemony, even with very harsh U.S. sanctions.
Iran has opened its bid at the U.N.'s top court to unfreeze billions of dollars in assets held by the U.S. Tehran says that Washington has created an industry of litigation against it in breach of international law. Iran took the U.S. to the International Court of Justice in 2016. That after the U.S. Supreme Court ordered some $2 billion in Iranian assets to be frozen and ordered the cash to go to survivors and relatives of attacks blamed on the Islamic Republic. Iran denies the allegations, saying the seizure is illegal. Iranian lawyers told the judges at The Hague that U.S. legislation does not bother with proof, attribution, or responsibility. Iran says the freezing of the funds breached the 1955 Treaty of Amity with the U.S., signed before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Washington had previously, unsuccessfully, sought to have the lawsuit thrown out. Iran is commemorating its National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq. Iran's War University has hosted a ceremony to recount the humanitarian impacts of the 8-year war. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Venise, along with military attaches from different embassies. To attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turning now to Ukraine, where war is entering its seventh month. Moscow has rejected Kiev's claims committing war crimes in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv after it fell into Russian hands. Moscow says the allegations of mass graves in the Ukrainian city are nothing but lies and fabrications. The Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that Moscow would stand up for the truth in the story. Last week, 450 graves were discovered in a forest area after the Ukrainian army recaptured the strategic eastern city from Russian forces. President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that investigations of the site revealed signs of violent death, accusing Russia of committing war crimes. Moscow, however, has refuted the accusations of extrajudicial killings there. Europeans are already feeling the pinch from skyrocketing energy prices amid the Russia-Ukraine war. Governments are now working on various contingency plans to cope with potential energy shortages this winter. Germany says it's planning to sign contracts with the UAE to purchase liquefied natural gas and to build new LNG terminals. In France, energy group EDF is racing to repair corrosion-hit nuclear reactors. Officials say that exceptional measures could include localized electricity cuts if the winter was too cold and EDF's plans were delayed. And Spanish officials say that they might oblige energy-intensive companies to close down during consumption peaks if required. Citizens in Finland have been warned by the country's national grid operator that they should be prepared for power outages. Russia supplied about 40% of the EU's gas before the Ukraine war. Moscow now says Western sanctions have hindered gas exports, but Europeans accuse Russia of using energy as a weapon. The Yemeni Human Rights Group has released a report on what it calls Saudi Arabia's violations of a UN-backed truce since its beginning in April. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN-brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation.
Palestinian students across the occupied West Bank express solidarity with their colleagues in East Al-Quds, who have gone on a mass strike against Israel's attempts to distort school textbooks. Children held banners denouncing the Israeli violation of the right to education as they rallied in their schools in support of striking students in Al-Quds. The Palestinian Minister of Education, Marwan Awartani, also voiced his concern over the Israeli move. Awartani, who was attending an educational summit in New York, called on the international community to help protect the right to education for Palestinian students. Palestinians in Al-Quds say that the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods, chanting slogans such as No to the Distorted Curriculum and no to Judaizing education. Our Ramallah correspondent Monica Ndiaye joined us earlier to tell us more about Israeli plans to impose distorted textbooks in Palestinian schools in Al-Quds.
The Israeli authorities and the municipality of Al-Quds have decided to censor and edit Palestinian textbooks. So it's not allowed to mention anything about Palestinian prisoners, Palestinian martyrs, the cause of the Palestinians, the issue of the Palestinian refugees, even mentioning examples in any topics or in any subjects about mentioning even the names of martyrs or the word martyrs and prisoners is not allowed. These textbooks are demanded by the Israeli authorities to be edited. Otherwise, they would be closing or not giving license to these schools. This happened for six schools in the beginning of this year. The municipality of Al-Quds demanded these six schools to edit their textbooks. Otherwise, they will completely be closed.
The coffin of Queen Elizabeth II leaves the iconic Westminster Abbey in the British capital after her state funeral, attended by leaders and representatives of different countries. The Queen will be laid to rest alongside her late husband, Prince Philip, during a private service and burial after 10 days of mourning. Tens of thousands of people have traveled to London for the state funeral and burial service, which is being broadcast live. Monday has already been declared a public holiday. Thousands of people have packed onto the streets to file past the Queen's coffin. The final ritual will also be screened to crowds in parks and public spaces in the UK and across the world. Elizabeth died on September 8, at the age of 96, after reigning more than 70 years as Britain's monarch. Moving on, Beijing deplores comments by U.S. President Joe Biden that forces will defend Taiwan in case of what he called the Chinese invasion of the island. China's foreign ministry says the country firmly opposes Washington's stance and has lodged solemn representations with the U.S. The ministry says Beijing reserves the right to take all necessary measures in response to separatist activities. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It has been locked in tensions with the U.S. over the issue. Tensions have soared over visits by the U.S. House Speaker and other American lawmakers to Taiwan in August. China has conducted several large-scale military drills around the island following the visits. Another damning report on big oil. Major oil companies have been found guilty yet again when it comes to their climate-related commitments. Although this does not surprise anyone, it puts into question the oversight on these energy conglomerates, from emissions to their green energy commitments. And now that they are making record profits, the heat is on for them to be held accountable and to follow through in preventing global warming.
Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
Bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline. Criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists. Like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, England Failing to Invest in Water Networks to Avoid Future Droughts. The UK's infrastructure chief has warned England is failing to invest in the water networks needed to avoid a future of recurrent serious droughts, with current policies amounting to the government keeping its fingers crossed. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, said, with more hot, dry spells interspersed with heavier rainfall, the current drought was a warning that water systems could not cope with the changing climate. He warned, investment is better than keeping your fingers crossed and relying on emergency measures. He said ministers could not prevent dry weather, but they could direct investment into infrastructure to cope with it, such as reservoirs and cutting wastage. Sir John Armitt added, the government should set out what degree of risk from drought they would see as reasonable for people to manage and expect. He warned water bills may have to increase to pay for the investment needed. Sir John Armitt told The Guardian in an interview, if you want greater resilience to drought, then you have to increase water bills or general taxation to pay for it. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more, as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. In several areas in the drought-stricken south of England, people have been forced to queue in the street as their water systems failed. In the village of North End in Oxfordshire, people have been relying on tankers. In and around Guildford in Surrey, handouts of bottled water began at the weekend after a pump failure at Netley Mill Treatment Works. in Everton in Bedfordshire, an already unreliable supply has been further threatened by drought. Hydrologists have claimed these are isolated incidents and that measures such as standpipes, a vivid memory for some from the last most serious drought in 1976, were highly unlikely to be needed in the current drought, as water companies were more resilient and better prepared than they were nearly half a century ago. The National Infrastructure Commission has estimated the cost of overhauling the UK's water networks at £20 billion by 2050, considerably less than the £27 billion the government has earmarked for new roads this Parliament, which campaigners say are not needed. Sir John Ahmed said this cost was dwarfed by the cost of drought. He warned, in increasingly frequent droughts, you'll probably have to spend twice that much on bottled water from the back of lorries. He said new reservoirs should be strongly considered, despite the difficulty of obtaining planning permission, particularly in the southeast of England. In an interview with The Guardian, he noted water metering was also likely to be needed to encourage people to cut their usage of water, but the government is not keen. Sir John Ahmed, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, called for a national debate on how to fund water improvements. The two Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, have called for action but shied away from setting out clear proposals on investment. Sir John Ahmed asked, "You have to balance water investment. Do you put it back through people's bills or through general taxation?" adding, "You have to ensure poor people are not being penalised." He said the role of water companies should be scrutinised. He noted, "There has been criticism of water companies paying dividends to investors. That has to be an issue for governments and regulators to decide." He added, "You can argue that water companies have invested too little. Going forward, the real challenge is for government to say what level of performance the public should be entitled to expect." People could have a substantial impact on water usage by changing their behaviour, for instance by not leaving taps running and running washing machines only on full loads. But Sir John Ahmed warned this would not be enough alone, and the government under a new Prime Minister would face uncomfortable choices over the investment needed for new reservoirs and new infrastructure. He said, "There is a cost of living crisis, especially with energy bills, and people don't want to hear about water bills going up too." He added, "But one way or another, we have to find a way to pay for this new infrastructure." Sir John Ahmed added, "Poorer households could be protected if the government stepped in to make the current billing systems fairer." England has experienced its driest July since 1911, with only about 10% of the average rainfall for the time of year in the south of England. The period since November has been the driest 8-month period in England since 1976. After a drier spell for almost 50 years, the United Kingdom is now being warned to expect flooding from thundery showers that will offer little relief from the drought. The flood alert follows days of extreme heat warnings and the official declaration of a drought after the longest 9-month dry spell since 1976. Meteorologists warned that downpours are the wrong kind of rain to tackle the drought and are more likely to lead to flash floods from water running off parched earth. The heat wave is forecast to break with a yellow warning for thunderstorms covering almost all of the United Kingdom, all of England and Wales, and most of southern and eastern England in the coming days. The Meteorological Office warned of torrential downpours and possible disruption in some spots, adding that homes and businesses could be flooded quickly and buildings damaged by floodwater. It also said power cuts were possible. The Environment Agency also warned that properties could flood and travel could be disrupted by surface water. John Curtin, the agency's executive director of operations, tweeted that the United Kingdom was in that twilight zone of having both flood and drought warnings. He said heavy thundery rain on parched and hard ground would lead to rapid runoff and heightened flood risk in the coming days. But this will in no way correct weeks of dry weather, so most of England will remain in drought. Professor Hannah Cloke, an expert in hydrology at the University of Reading, said the forecast rain was unlikely to be long-lasting or widespread enough to make a big difference to some exceptionally low levels in reservoirs and rivers. Dan Stroud, a forecaster at the Meteorological Office, said, "We're coming to the end of an extended very hot spell, and the ground has been baked, so it's extremely dry. The weather is breaking down into a mixture of heavy and thundery showers." Dan Stroud added, "And rain from really intense downpours will be unable to soak into the baked ground quickly. It's very difficult for the water to actually get in because it has to force the air out of the soil. So dry ground gets very quickly overwhelmed and we then get surface runoff." He added, "What we really need is a continuous period of light rain or drizzle just to gently re-wet the soil. Intense downpours are not exceptionally helpful. It's going to take a lot of rain over an extended period of time to actually recharge the aquifers and reservoirs." Dan Stroud added, "Almost anywhere was at risk of the impact of thundery downpours, but it was difficult to pinpoint exactly where." He said, "Scotland and Northern Ireland were most at risk. The risk develops initially across Wales and the southwest of England, and then more widely across England during the coming days." Rob Thompson, who conducted the demonstration, said, "Dry, parched ground doesn't let water in as effectively as already moist ground because the soil is resisting water entering. The water sits on the surface to run off down slopes or simply sit in a pool." Three water companies, Welsh Water, Southern Water and South East Water, have imposed hosepipe bans, while Yorkshire Water has announced that a ban will start on 26th of August, and Thames Water is planning one in the coming weeks.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
This movement of Imam Hussein was led by a ma'soom. When it is led by a ma'soom, everything is going to be the way it's supposed to be. And it just shows the difference. Sometimes some of us might act like, you know, we know what we're doing. Okay, we try our best. But yeah, there will be mistakes that are made. We have to understand that. So that if someone's not going to necessarily agree with me the way I'm doing things, I don't say, oh, you're against Islam. Who are you to represent Islam? We're all fallible beings. Yeah? This one, though, had an imam leading it. That's why we see the rewards of it, the fruits of it. We see it till today. Or else there were so many movements. I skipped one of the movements that I listed last night. You have Abdullah bin Hanzala. You have the Tawabin. The Tawabin, like, it didn't work. I'm sorry. Yeah? You have all of these movements. Zayd bin Ali, Yahya bin Zayd, Hussein ibn Ali, Shahid of Fakh. All of these people, nothing in the end. No one remembers them. But with Imam Hussein, it was different. Although some of them were killed the exact same way Imam Hussein was killed. All right, so let's move on to the next one now. So far, what do we have? Let me see. We have Allah's will. We have ikhlas. We have the movement was led by an imam. We have the different elements that we have in this movement. We have haq. We have Lady Zainab and Imam Sajjad. It doesn't matter how great a job you do, how great a sacrifice you make. If that is not promoted properly and not explained properly, it'll just go down the drain. And so this is another part of Allah's plan. Think about it. Imam Hussein, no matter how hard if he had tried, do you think he would have been able to make it to the heart of the enemy in Sham? Into the belly of the beast itself in Sham? No, they would have stopped him before coming. They stopped him before getting to Kufa, let alone Sham. And so what we get out of this is that apparently this is part of the plan for Imam Hussein to make his way as close as he can to become Shaheed, so that the enemy himself takes Zainab alayhi salam and Sajjad alayhi salam into Sham. So then they have that platform, they have that microphone, so to speak, to expose, to the point that Yazid, till yesterday, he's all gloating and he's all proud, and all of a sudden he's sending his la'nat on Ubaydullah bin Ziyad. And then he says, take these prisoners back, give them whatever they want, take them back, just get them out of here. And still they say when Bibi Zainab went back, she was causing trouble for the hukuma in those 2 years. That's one of the reasons some believe that one of the evidences they have for Bibi Zainab being buried in Sham is that she was sent in exile. Why? Because she wasn't keeping silent. Imam Sajjad is different. But Bibi Zainab did her thing. Just like Bibi Fatima, Imam Ali was not as loud as Bibi Fatima because they had different responsibilities in what happened after Saqifah. Same thing here. All right, so with Imam Sajjad, 34 years, he is not holding big majalis or anything, but every opportunity he gets, he will explain Karbala, he will explain Ashura, he will hold majlises to the extent he can, even if it means it's a one-person majlis kind of, where he brings up Imam Hussein in front of others. Anything he sees, food, drink, animals being slaughtered, he will bring up Imam Hussein. So that's another element. And says a lot to us, you know. Sometimes there's a lot of work that we're doing. We're not promoting it properly, not explaining it properly to people. It goes to waste. And then others will say, oh, Mulana, you should do more. You should do more. No, it's not about doing more. It's about what? It's about reaching out, branching out, letting people know what's going on. Or else, if I double the amount of work I'm doing, but if I'm not getting it out there properly, what's that mean? That just means the drain is going to clog, but everything's going down the drain at the end of the day. You have to be smart and efficient about things as well. If I'm doing one thing, in this day and age where I have no choice but to have some voice on social media, I will blow it up as much as I can so that it reaches the people it's supposed to reach. Back then, they used the tools they had, poetry and whatnot. Imam Sajjad uses every opportunity. That's what I'll do. Yes, which brings me to the last four. And these are the tools now that Allah, I think that Allah set there. I talked a little bit about last night, but I want to get into some of the hadiths in this regard and some of the stories we have. What were the tools? Number one, majalis. Number two, tears. Number three, his turba even, the dust from his grave. And finally, his ziyara and his grave. I want to share with you some of the stories and some of the hadiths we have in this regard to show us that, yeah, when Allah gives it the magical touch, yes, that is different than whatever else is out there. The majalis, the importance of majalis. I have a few stories here that I've heard scholars in Iran, they speak about. There's tons of stories. And you see some of the posts that we have online as well in regards to some of these stories. Ayatollah Uzma Golpayegani. I'm trying to make a point with these stories here, okay? Because in all of these stories, you'll notice that it's not a big majlis. Although it's in the 21st century. It's not a big majlis though. What am I trying to get to here? I'm trying to make a point here of how important these majalis are, even if it's two people. Ayatollah Golpayegani, I haven't seen the video, but this scholar was saying that there's a video of it. Ayatollah Uthma Gulpaygani. You know what that's like? That's like Ayatollah Wahid Khurasani of today. Huge. Like Ayatollah Sistani of today. Okay? Says that there's a video of him doing a majlis with his family. Why? Of course they want the thawab of it, but more importantly, they know that this is what's kept it alive. Imam Sajjad did it with few people. If I can only get a few people. I don't know what the circumstances were back then that he was doing it with his family, but it's like, in other words, it's not like he's not doing anything. Or another story. He says that Rasuli Mahallati, he's a person, he's passed away. He says that he comes to Imam Khomeini. He tells Imam Khomeini, there's somebody out there, they've made a nazr. Yes, you know that oath that you make or that vow you make with Allah that you're going to do something. Not the other nazr. Nazr. That they're going to have a majlis and you're going to be in it. Imam Khomeini's like, I didn't ask for it. Like, what is this, you know? So Imam Khomeini says, it's okay. No problem. Recite. He says, but there's no majlis. He says, no, I'm here. Recite. He says, I started reciting. Imam Khomeini began weeping. That's our majlis. I'm not going to wait for it to ever happen. Let's see if it happens, if we're able to facilitate it or not. Okay, a person has a nazr. They want to do this. This is a majlis. What does majlis literally mean when you sit down? We're sitting. We're hearing the Messiah of Imam Hussein. This one I like a lot. Sheikh Qara'ati, those of you who know him, you know him. He's famous, right? Sheikh Qara'ati, he says, years ago, 40 years ago or so, he says, I was in Mozambique. I don't know what he's doing there, but he was there. He says, you know, we weren't able to get a flight back to Iran, all that, and so Ashura, turns out I'm going to be in Mozambique, of all places. 40 years ago. Now, there might be Shia there, but 40 years ago, he says, there were no Shia there. So he says, I got stuck there. I asked on the night of Ashura if there are any majlises. They said there aren't any Shias here. But there's this one guy who has a little shop who sells halal food stuff. Yeah? This is like 30 years ago, guys. Like, this is how we lived the life here, the halal life in America. 30 years ago, there was no halal restaurants. Growing up in North Carolina, we had to drive all the way to Washington, D.C., Maryland to get our hands on some halal chicken. All this for halal meat. He says that they told me there's one Shia guy here who sells halal stuff. He has like a little shop, a little supermarket, whatever. He says, I went and asked him if there were any majlises in the city. He said, no. But from the beginning of Muharram every night, I recite for my family at home. How did Imam Hussein, the story of Imam Hussein survive? Because of these things. I recite from my family at home. Qara'ati, he says, I said, I'm going to come. And so I went, and this brother would recite, and his family would mourn. So during COVID, we got a taste of that, by the way. We had our little majlises at home. Yes, we had a lot. Alhamdulillah for the internet. Yes. And so alhamdulillah, it wasn't like, it was a good experience, I would say. It might have strengthened us a lot more than we think when it comes to our resolve for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So that's another one. The fact that these majalis keep happening. And so you can't stress it enough, the importance of these majalis, the tears. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I've spoken about this before in length. The tears and how man baka wa abka wa tabaka, the one who cries, the one who makes others cry, the one who can't cry but at least acts like they're crying. All of these people, what blessings are awaiting them in the hadiths we have. There are too many for us to deny them, these hadiths. Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah and to my last breath, I will remember Hussein. Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah. Troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah.
Until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
I don't know why. Eating breakfast in the nature really hits the spot. What a delicious jam. Different taste. After drinking a cup of Iranian tea, I sit up. I have the necessary stuff for an exciting adventure. And here's my backpack. Oh, listen. Very sweet. Here we have the birds singing, the beautiful nature, and a new adventure in Iran. Yes, I'm in Shirabad Park in Golestan province, and our today's destination is Shirabad Waterfall. Stay with me. Shirabad Waterfall is in Alborz mountain range in Golestan province, northern Iran. Shirabad Waterfall is in the form of a stairway cascade and includes 12 large and small waterfalls. Its largest waterfall is 35 meters high. There is a cave on top of the waterfalls. Water flows inside the cave, which is a habitat for wildlife species such as the Iranian salamander. A large part of the cave is in absolute darkness. There is a spring at the end of the cave. There are various trees and shrubs outside the cave, such as hornbeam, maple, alder, and moss. Shirabad Waterfall has been registered on the National Heritage List. Fresh air. Oh, pure oxygen. I am in the forest. There are trees and different types of herbs here. Oh, I love these ferns. Look at them. Shirabad has a very different flora. And over there, you can see maple and alder trees. Oh no! I was about to put my feet on these colorful mushrooms. You know, I'm very careful. I watch my footsteps. You should walk on a well-trodden path so that the nature will be protected. After passing the rocks, I see the waterfall. Now, here it is, the first Shirabad waterfall. However, it's refreshing. The depth of these waterfalls are different. Some of them are very deep and some others are shallow. Oh no, it's showering. Oh God. So, let me take shelter in a cave above here. So, a change in the plan. I am now in a cave on the way to the second waterfall. It is called Shirabad Cave. I am here. Thank God I've brought my headlights. Oh, sorry, bats. I disturbed you. The walls of the cave get narrower and shorter as you step forward. It's sighing. At the end of the cave, there is a spring. But unfortunately, I can't continue caving because I have to come back to my residence before night. I wish I had time for more exploration. The rain stopped. Here we have clean air and piles of oxygen. Oh, it's dreamy here. And the only thing which is needed now is a cup of Iranian tea.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. With regards to achievements, I believe the most important thing this government has achieved is that it has revived hope and trust in people. In some cases, these efforts have also had tangible results that the people have witnessed themselves. For example, improvements in the health sector, diplomacy, and some cultural sectors have shown clear, distinct results. Some of these have achieved results, therefore people need to be shown these results. There have been results, but people need to be told about the results and the outcomes. In some cases, the efforts have made not yet come to fruition. However, it can be sensed that work is being done. To me, these things are your greatest accomplishments.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the other accomplishments you've made may be seen in your provisional trips. These are truly brilliant. It is a very important matter that this administration has made 31 trips to various points across the country in just 11 months. To deprived and remote areas and some rare things have taken place, and a deep empathy has been shown towards the people. Their problems have been mentioned and assessed in the field. This is a very important, and I shall talk about this again in the recommendations I will make that are associated with this matter. One of the other achievements you've made has been your quick response when dealing with unforeseen events such as floods and other disasters that have taken place. This speed in your actions is very important. This is of a great value that an official rushes immediately to the scene whenever there is an earthquake or a flood somewhere, and they monitor and organize the relief work that needs to be carried out there.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.